Amateur Radio Newsline Report Number 1862, with a release date of April 19, 2013, to follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. Ham Radio takes the point position after a terror attack on the Boston Marathon. The FCC says that the 2011 National EAS test is considered to be a success. The SARL gets two frequencies at 5 megahertz to do a propagation study. A special event station in May will honor the Native American Code Talkers. And will everyone in the world be online by 2020? All this and more on Amateur Radio Newsline Report Number 1862, coming your way right now.
From around the world, this is Newsline, Amateur Radio's independent, on-the-air news and bulletin service. Now, from Charleston, West Virginia, here's Jeff Clark, KAJAC.
Some 250 ham radio operators were providing communications for the Boston Marathon on Monday, April 15th, when a pair of bombs, believed planted by a terrorist, went off, killing three onlookers and sending scores to local hospitals, some with very serious and life-threatening injuries. Amateur Radio Newsline's Mark Abramovich, NT3V, is here with what's known about the attack and the role played by hams on the scene.
It is a day Paul Topolsky, W1 Sierra Echo X-Ray, will never forget. Topolsky tells Newsline that he was working with radio operators close to the finish line of the Boston Marathon, and things were going well. And then there was the first blast.
I was in the net control trailer about 400 feet from where the blast was. Things were going pretty smooth, and we were commenting on that. All of the operations that we had were up and running, and no real issues. And within a couple of minutes, my assistant and I were just happened to be looking at each other out of the corner of our eye, and then that blast hit and shook the trailer, and we knew it wasn't good.
Topolsky says when the second blast went off and they knew things were going to be brought to a halt, he says their big concern was operators at the medical tents at each mile along the route.
Your net control immediately started doing a roll call and finding out where all our people were, exact locations, and their condition, making sure that they were okay. And as it turns out, everybody was just fine and continuing operations.
Just before that roll call began, Topolsky told his counterpart overseeing net control on the course to reach out to him on a secure line. Steve Schwarm, W3 Echo Victor Echo, also spoke with Newsline about the events of that day. He was on the receiving end of that call and was a bit surprised.
He calls me on the radio and says, call me on my cell phone. And I know something's got to be wrong because he'll only talk to me on the cell phone when it's something he doesn't want anybody else to hear. So I called him on the cell phone, and that's when he told me the two bombs had gone off in downtown. And he said, I don't know what's going to happen next, but thought you'd like to know. And I said, thanks. So I stopped all the activity in my net control and announced it to everybody there. And I said that we don't know what's going to happen next, but I'm quite sure the race is probably over.
Topolsky, who was at that medical tent close to the finish line, says once it was established all those close to the bomb locations were okay, there was general agreement among the operators to stay at their posts and assist.
It was a kind of a mindset, okay, we did have a problem, and let's continue to do our job. And everybody did just that until we were finally sent on our way by the Boston Police Department and the Massachusetts State Police because we were literally, right in the Ground Zero area. We were in the crime scene, so we had to bug out.
But before they were sent out, Topolsky says the operators were busy helping the medical personnel.
Instead of taking care of runners, we were now working with the medical people who were serving casualties from the incident itself. We had medical coverage or coverage in the medical tents, and we started receiving reports of those injuries and the types of things that were going on. And then we were relaying that information to the public safety people via WebEOC and other means.
Topolsky estimates those closest to the blast zones were there for about 35 minutes afterward until they got sent out because of concerns among authorities about other possible devices. Back to Schwarm at CourseNet Control, who in the minutes after the blast was now working with operators still out on the course.
Police were ordering people to stop. So runners tended to congregate at the first aid stations and the water fluid stations along the course, and all of them had ham radio operators. So as soon as that happened, we told everybody on the frequency what was going on. The event had stopped, and they would start to organize those people. And then we started to use some of our medical sleep buses to take the runners to some predetermined shelters. The original thought was that if we had something like a thunderstorm come through and had lightning and things like that, we wouldn't want all these people on the course. So that was the original intended use for the shelters, but they found out that they could be used for this as well.
Schwarm says for the operators close to the blast zones, it was a hectic time.
They supply communications for the medical tents, and that was where a lot of the initial triage of the runners occurred. And a lot of lives were probably saved because they had basically a first-class emergency room right there.
But the day was far from over for Topolsky and his operators, who were evacuated from the developing crime scene, Schwarm says.
The roles actually got reversed because they were concerned about having another device in the area, so they had a lot of people evacuate. And Paul and his team evacuated, and several of his operators came up to help me in case we were going to be doing an extended operation, and it wasn't clear how long it was going to take for us to get this thing cleaned up. And they came up to help in case we needed some backup. I was very concerned about some of my net control operators getting exhausted and needing some backup. So I knew he had some good people, and they came up to help out.
So where was net control for the course? Schwarm says the Boston area hams put it at a perfect location.
We're actually quite a distance from the course. We're about a mile or two from the course. It's at a facility. It's a private school in Brookline, which is a suburb of Boston. And it's on top of a very high hill, which if we had to, we could probably work every single repeater we use with a 100-milliwatt walkie-talkie because we can see them all, literally. And it makes an ideal location for it. And we also then have high-speed internet at our fingertips and several phone lines and a few things like that. It's a very nice facility.
So what form of communications do the hams who work the Boston Marathon use? VHF frequencies, Schwarm says.
The Boston Marathon is the only marathon that's run in a straight line. And we plan on having HT coverage for the entire course and the finish and the start. So as a result, you tend to use a fair number of frequencies to make that happen. We use five separate repeaters to cover five sections of the course. And then we have a network of links repeaters that we use to cover the entire course from beginning to end just for things that need to be covered across that range.
Topolsky has been involved in the marathon amateur radio coverage for 20 years. For Schwarm, this was his 13th year, and he says it won't be his last.
I think what you'll find is that next year we're going to have a bigger and better Boston Marathon, and we're going to go on. I mean, we went through a lot of planning and soul searching for these kinds of things after 9/11. And this was probably a wake-up call to rethink some of those.
For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Mark Abramovich, NT3V, in Philadelphia.
Well, our hearts go out to the families of those who lost loved ones and those injured in this unprovoked and uncivilized attack against humanity. We'll have more for you in upcoming Amateur Radio Newsline reports. The Independent Communications Authority of South Africa has just approved two frequencies at 5 megahertz for the South African Radio League to carry out propagation research. This is in response to the Society's application to collect information about countrywide propagation conditions in that spectrum. The South African Radio League had applied for access to 5 megahertz in 2010, 2011, and again in 2012. In its application, the Society told the telecommunications regulator that while the propagation of signals are fairly well known for high-power broadcasting, there is still quite a lot that can be learned by radio amateurs, especially away from the coastline. The licenses are being issued for an 8-month period, but the regulator says that at the end of the period, the South African Radio League can apply for an extension. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline, heard on bulletin stations around the world, including the KA8HDY repeater serving Jackson, Michigan. The final results of the first National Emergency Alert System, or EAS, test show that 83% of broadcasters successfully received the alert. Amateur Radio Newsline's Heather MB, KB3TZD, reports.
The first national EAS test was held on November 9, 2011. Now, in a long-awaited and very detailed review, the FCC Public Safety and Homeland Security Bureau says that while the test demonstrated EAS would generally perform as designed, it also shined a bright light on several areas that require improvement. The 19-page report says that of the nearly 14,000 radio and TV stations that submitted result data, only 2,300 failed to successfully receive and broadcast the alert. The number would likely have been lower. However, 3 of the 63 primary entry point stations failed, which meant a larger number of stations further down the daisy chain did not get the alert. While the majority of stations received the national EAS alert, results varied state by state. The report points out that while fewer than 2% of Texas stations didn't get the test on air, nearly every Oregon station didn't broadcast the complete alert. The bottom line is that the FCC and FEMA have concluded that the nationwide EAS architecture is basically sound, but that there's room for improvement. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Heather Emby, KB3TZD in Berwick, Pennsylvania.
The agencies involved say that they plan more national EAS tests in the future. You can read the FCC's in-depth report on the national EAS test at tinyurl.com/EAS-results. The FCC is seeking public comment on a proposed regulatory change to limit complaints to the agency dealing with broadcast indecency. Amateur Radio Newsline's Norm Seeley, KI7UP, is here with details.
The FCC indicates that General Docket Number 1386 has been issued because it has a backlog of complaints dealing with alleged broadcast indecency and no way for it to investigate and act on each one individually. It notes that after the Supreme Court's decision in FCC versus Fox Television Stations Incorporated in September 2012, Chairman Janikowski instructed commission staff to begin a review of the commission's broadcast indecency policies and enforcement to ensure they are fully consistent with vital First Amendment principles. In the interim, the chairman directed the Enforcement Bureau to focus its indecency enforcement resources on egregious cases and to reduce the backlog of pending broadcast indecency complaints. Since September 2012, the Enforcement Bureau has reduced the backlog by 70%. That amounts to more than 1 million complaints. Most of these were simply beyond the statute of limitations or too stale to pursue. That involved cases outside FCC jurisdiction that contained insufficient information or that were closed by settled precedent. The FCC says that the Enforcement Bureau is actively investigating egregious indecency cases and will continue to do so. However, it is now seeking comment on whether the full commission should make changes to its current broadcast indecency policies or maintain them as they are. For example, the commission wants to know if they should treat isolated expletives in a manner consistent with the way it currently does based on its decision in the Pacifica Foundation case of the 1960s. Or should it intend maintain the approach to isolated expletives set forth in its decision in complaints against various broadcast licensees regarding their airing of the Golden Globe Awards program in 2004? It also wants to know if it should treat isolated, non-sexual nudity the same as or differently than isolated expletives. The FCC says commenters are invited to address these issues, as well as any other aspect of the Commission's indecency policies. It also notes that the issuance of General Docket 1386 does not alter any of the Commission's current indecency policies. That means acceptance of new complaints and ongoing enforcement action will continue as is until the issues in General Docket 1386 have been decided. For Amateur Radio Newsline, Norm Seeley, KI7UP in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Comments on FCC General Docket Number 13-86 will be due in 30 days after publication in the Federal Register, with a reply comment due no later than 60 days after publication. You can download and read the text of this proposed rulemaking at tinyurl.com/FCC-indecency-rules. A free repeater directory app for the UK, Europe, Australia, New Zealand, and South America, and more, is now available for iPhone and Android-based smart devices. Repeater Locator enables the traveling ham to easily find repeaters across most populated areas of the world using GPS or a locator to find repeaters. The app also makes available the complete database of United Kingdom Analog, IRLP, Echolink, and D-Star repeaters, and a growing world repeater database covering all but North America. Also, the Android version supports the BlueCat, FT-857, and FT-817 Bluetooth CAT interface that'll allow a user to simply touch a repeater to instantly access the radio. You can find Repeater Locator by searching for the ZBM2 at the Apple App Store or the Play Store. According to an April 13th posting to the Dayton Hamvention Yahoo Group's remailer from the University of Dayton, the campus housing had about 15 rooms each accommodating 4 to 6 people available for Hamvention weekend. The posting by the university notes that it's been offering lodging to Hamvention attendees for over 15 years. If you're looking for a last-minute place to stay for this year's Hamvention, try taking your web browser to tickets.udayton.edu. IZ8EDJ reports that details of Italy's 9th International DX Convention to be held on April 28th. It's at tinyurl.com/italy-dx-meeting. The official website for the convention itself is on the web at www.dxitalia.it. Here in the USA, meanwhile, Julie N. Zoller, KJ4EMJ, has succeeded Richard C. Baird at the Department of State. This is in the role of Senior Deputy Coordinator at the Office of Multilateral Affairs, Communications and Information Policy Directorate, Economics and Business Affairs Bureau. The ARRL reports that in this position, she'll serve as Principal Advisor to the United States Coordinator for International Communications and Information Policy. More on her appointment is online at tinyurl.com/Zoller-appointment. The Lawton Fort Sill Amateur Radio Club will be hosting a special event station from May 8th through the 11th at the Comanche National Museum in Lawton, Oklahoma. This will commemorate the work of the Comanche Code Talkers of World War II. According to Wikipedia, the Code Talkers were people who used obscure languages as a means of secret communication during wartime. The term is now usually associated with the United States soldiers during the World Wars who used their knowledge of Native American languages as a basis to transmit coded messages. There were approximately 400 to 500 Native Americans in the United States Marine Corps whose primary job was the transmission of secret tactical messages. Code Talkers transmitted these messages over military telephone or radio communications nets using formal or informally developed codes built upon their native languages. Their service improved communications in terms of speed of encryption at both ends in frontline operations during World War II. The recent National Association of Broadcasters annual radio luncheon provided the setting for the presentation of the 10 NAB Crystal Radio Awards. The event also featured a keynote speaker from famed composer, musician, and program host John Tesh, the induction of Dave Ramsey into the NAB Broadcasting Hall of Fame, and a Crystal Heritage Award to radio station KNOM, AM and FM of Nome, Alaska. The Crystal Radio Awards recognize radio stations for their outstanding year-round commitment to community service. The luncheon was sponsored by ASCAP, the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. For those not aware, John Tesh wrote and performed the music score for the 1986 ARRL video, The New World of Amateur Radio. This is Ham Radio News for today's radio amateur. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline, with links to the world from our only official website at www.arnewsline.org, and being relayed by the volunteer services of the following radio amateur. Two college professors who are also ham radio operators have received a substantial monetary grant from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory to help them construct and launch a research satellite. Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, is in our newsroom with more.
Professors Charlene Katz, WB6FFE, and James Flynn, WB9AWX, are part of a California State University at Northridge team that has received $25,000 from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory for a CubeSat research project. There is also an award of $30,000 for the project listed by the university's corporation. The April 15th edition of the campus newspaper, The Sundial, carried a report on the university's CubeSat project that has a mission of testing alternative power techniques for satellites and other spacecraft. Measuring only 10 by 10 by 20 centimeters, the satellite will be packed with solar cells and special software to achieve this goal. In order to communicate with the CubeSat, the team is also building an automated ground station atop one of the campus buildings. The station will not only help the team track the university's CubeSat, but also other satellites as well. This is because it will become part of the global educational network of satellite operations. This is a community of universities around the world that track and communicate with satellites. Currently, the project is in Phase 1. Phase 2 is set to start during the fall semester of 2013, and the team is hoping to complete the satellite by December of 2014. Typically, it would cost another $45,000 just to launch such a satellite, but thanks to the sponsorship of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, the satellite will be hitching a ride to orbit in just a few years. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, in the newsroom in Los Angeles.
You can read the full story of the creation of this new bird online. It's at tinyurl.com/cal-state-northridge-satellite. A ham radio related youth workshop on Saturday, April 13th at the Lake Washington Institute of Technology in Kirkland, Washington, is being called a big success. This thanks to the hard work of the amateur radio support team at the event. According to planners, there were over 100 electricity, electronics, and radio merit badges completed by the 58 youngsters who were registered at the event. These are considered science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, or STEM merit badges, and part of the STEM NOVA Award, sponsored by the Boy Scouts of America. There were 14 adults and 14 scouts that qualified for their amateur radio licenses. 5 of the adults were scoutmasters. Some of the others were from scouting troops and the Lake Washington Ham Club. Another event of this type is in the planning stages for September 14. Southern California's Papa System and the Palomar Amateur Radio Club will jointly host an operating day at Fry's Electronics in the city of San Marcos on Sunday, April 28. This will be a demonstration to educate the public about how amateur radio helps in the community. Club members will be available to answer questions and encourage the public to try amateur radio on site. They'll be demonstrating HF through 70 centimeter operations, plus D-Star, packet radio, and Winlink. For more information on this event, please drop an email to admin@papasys.com. A word of congratulations to the Catalina, California 2-meter repeater as it celebrates 40 years of continuous service to the region's ham radio community. It was April 27, 1973. The system came on the air with a 10-watt voice from Catalina Island and an amazing 1,300 square mile coverage. Now in 2013, that system, operated by the Catalina Amateur Repeater Association, remains one of the most popular in the region. And over the 4 decades of its operation, there have been many improvements to both its coverage and the service it provides to the community. The complete story of the creation of this system, located some 26 miles off the Pacific coastline, was featured in the April 1974 cover story of 73 Magazine. Even though the magazine itself is long gone, you can read the story or download it from tinyurl.com, Catalina-repeater-AT-40. In DX, listen out for special event station XR86PL, to be active until April 30th to commemorate the 86th anniversary of the Chilean police. Operations are on all bands, including sideband, RIDI, and PSK. QSL via the operator's home call sign, or CE3-ETE. CT1FTR will be in Khartoum, Sudan until June. He's signing ST2FT. QSL is directed on the air. AC6 Delta will be active stroke 9A from Croatia, this during the RSGB Islands on the Air contest between July 27 and the 28th. If you make contact, QSL via AC6DD. KT3Y, K9VV, and WP2XX will be active from the KP2M rental shack on St. Croix Island during the CQ Worldwide WPX CW contest May 25th and 26th as a multi-single entry. QSL direct only via AI4U or Logbook of the World. No QSLs will be accepted via the Bureau. Lastly, ZL1GO and ZL3CW reportedly will use the call sign N8A during their American Samoa operation between November 12 and the 26th. More information on this upcoming operation as soon as it's made available. And finally this week, do you believe what Google Executive Chairman Eric Schmidt says, that everyone in the world will be online by the end of the decade? Amateur Radio Newsline's Cheryl Lacey, K9BIK, has the rest of this rather interesting prediction.
On Saturday, April 13th, Google Executive Chairman Eric Schmidt stated on his Google Plus blog that for every person online, there are two who are not. He went on to add that by the end of the decade, he predicted that everyone on Earth will be connected by 2020. A day later, Schmidt added, and we quote, "Think about how great the Internet is now with 2 billion users. Now think about how amazing it will be when 5 billion come online in a decade." But can Schmidt's prediction come true? As pointed out in one news article, Google itself supports a project called Geeks Without Frontiers. This is described as a nonprofit group that donates computers and related wireless access technology to poor areas around the world. The organization's current focus is to bring such wireless access to parts of Mexico, Central America, and Africa. These are regions without any traditional form of wired internet access. Also, back in 2011, Geeks Without Frontiers announced that it had developed its own low-cost open-source Wi-Fi software. At that time, it said that by driving down the cost of metropolitan and village-scale Wi-Fi networks, millions more people will be able to reap the economic and social benefits of significantly lower-cost internet access. The rise of the mobile access is expected to play a role. In parts of Africa, it's reported that more people have access to mobile phones than have electricity. Google itself notes that in South Africa, 25% of its searches during the week are made via mobile devices, and that rises to 65% on the weekends. So will every man, woman, and child be online by 2020? There's no way to be certain, but Google leaders rarely make predictions that they know won't come true. So the bottom line is, don't rule this one out. And if it does happen, it will likely be thanks to Wi-Fi, which is in itself nothing more than a form of digital two-way radio. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Cheryl Essek, K9BIK in Zion, Illinois.
According to the International Telecommunications Union, at this time approximately 38% of the world's population is currently using the Internet in some way. That's up from about 35% who were online in 2012. But with poor and developing nations around the world isolated by non-existent internet infrastructures and others hindered by government censorship, some wonder if Eric Schmidt's vision might be a bit overly optimistic. Then again, as time has proven, Google is rarely wrong. With thanks to Allen Labs, AMSAT, the ARRL, the CGC Communicator, CQ Magazine, the FCC, the Ohio Penn, DX Bulletin, Radio Netherlands, RAIN, the RSGB, the Southgate News, Twit TV, and Australia's WIA News, that's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline. Our email address is newsline@arnewsline.org. More information is available at Amateur Radio Newsline's only official website, located at www.arnewsline.org. You can also write to us or support us at Amateur Radio Newsline, 28197 Robin Avenue, Santa Clarita, California, 91350. For now, with Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, at the editor's desk, I'm Jeff Clark, K8JAC, saying 73, and we thank you for listening. Amateur Radio Newsline is copyright 2013, all rights reserved.